CliffCentral.com.
Jonathan Smith is a producer of one of the producers of the new BBC Earth series, Blue Planet 2. I had the pleasure of watching a little bit of it early this morning before Jonathan came in. And I said to him when I met him outside, it must feel really good to create something so unbelievably beautiful that will stand the test of time, that people will look at in 1,000 years from now and go, that is a snapshot of what the planet looked like at that time, filmed in the most beautiful, graceful, elegant, evocative way possible, and showing off really what a bounty life on Earth is. Even though we're doing huge damage to it, and even though there's plenty of reason to be concerned after watching the most incredible show, it is, it's humbling. It reminds us of our place in the scheme of things, and it's such a privilege to be able to watch this. I imagine Jonathan will tell us it's a privilege to film all of this too. It's a pleasure to meet you, Jonathan. Nice to meet you.
Well, thanks, Gareth. Thanks so much for having me, and pleasure to meet you too.
Is it a privilege to be involved in the lives of animals and of this ecosystem of the ocean? Is it a privilege, or is it a pain in the backside because you have to get yourself wet and cold and hot and dirty and sometimes uncomfortable?
Do you know, it's a mixture of both. You know, the time through the production, a long production like this, it's 4 years. Of course, there's ups and downs, and particularly with wildlife. You know, wildlife doesn't read a script. So you have to get out there, and sometimes that can be tough, and sometimes it can be wonderful. But what is without doubt a privilege is you saying things like that and using words like humbling, because really for the likes of me, and you know, it's truly humbling actually the response that people have had to Blue Planet 2. And you know, when you're making a series like this and you get so close to it and some of the stories and, like I say, the ups and downs, and when it finally goes out to the world and you look at the response we've had in, it's the most watched program in England this year, third most watched in the last 5 years. Wow. The opening program has had nearly 20 million views.
That restores my faith in humanity.
Well, in China, it's had over 220 million downloads, and it's just getting out there to the world now. You know, it shows in South Africa this Sunday the 4th at 4 p.m., and it's seeing this response, this global response, and it humbles me and it invigorates me to know that so many people share this passion for the natural world, and of course with Blue Planet too, for the oceans, and especially with the oceans being our ultimate realm of new discoveries on this planet.
Well, there are a couple of things that come out of just what you've said now that I'd like to get into. Let's start with the fact that you said 220 million people in China have watched it.
That's right.
Now, this is how we bring about change. This is how we change people's view of the environment, of conservation, of climate change, of pollution in the seas. I mean, if we can reach that many people, then we can make a difference. We can start changing the way people think about these things.
I love that you think that, and you know, my job isn't political.
No, I understand that.
And really what I'm doing is documenting the natural world, and if that many people watch it, as you say, and I think that the reason I make a particular point of saying my job in the political is because I think that I'm an observer, and that's what we've done, and that's what we've really done over the last 4 years.
But if you give us the opportunity, people all over the world, to see how the natural world works and how majestic it is when it works, and when there's balance, how much goes right, I think it can create, not just for the elites who have access to information, but for ordinary people, it can create a sense of wonder. And it can hopefully imbue people with a feeling of responsibility towards the world that we live in.
Do you know, I think you're absolutely right. And I think that now more than ever, we're seeing a lot of change. And again, as observers in the field, you know, the time that I've spent in the field for Blue Planet, I've seen more changes environmentally than in the whole rest of my career in the oceans. For my coral reef film, in 2016 and 2017, while we were there filming our stories and our character stories, we witnessed the biggest bleaching event, and a back-to-back coral bleaching event on the Barrier Reef. It's the biggest bleaching event in the entirety of human history, and where two-thirds of the shallow water corals were affected. And these are things that are happening in front of our eyes as we're out there in the world now.
How did that happen, and were you aware of it while it was happening?
It happened out of the blue. You know, I didn't plan to film a coral bleaching sequence for the coral reef film, but I did want to film the Great Barrier Reef, you know, the biggest living structure on the planet and one of the most amazing coral reefs that there is. And we found two particularly special stories there. One of a fish, a tusk fish, he's called. And he's got these really quite goofy teeth. And then really quite goofy teeth that he uses for picking up clams. But a clam is full of lovely meat, but it's really hard to get into. You imagine you and I try to prise open a clam in here, and imagine you're a little fish with no hands. You know, really quite tricky. But the tusk fish we've discovered, and this was a world first in us working this out for Blue Planet 2. Well, this tusk fish takes the clam back right across the reef to, as Sir David Attenborough describes it, his special kitchen. And this is a boulder coral that's been hollowed out. And inside it is a tool, an anvil. And it's a very special bit of coral that's been worn away by the tusk fish. And he brings the clam back to it every time. And then through sheer dogged determination, perseverance, and wonderful coordination, manages to use it as, again, the kind of things that you've seen Capuchins do before with tools and almonds. Well, this is a fish, and a fish using tools to open his clam.
Well, when we say humbling, it's also seeing how other animals aren't necessarily, in evolutionary terms, in a linear sequence, sillier or cleverer than us.
Absolutely. And actually, you're bang on, because intelligence comes in so many ways. The other sequence that I was filming on the Great Barrier Reef is, so as a producer, I'll be looking for stories that will break down a habitat and end up giving you the bigger picture of that habitat. And one major thing with a coral reef is it's three-dimensional. Mm. And by being a three-dimensional matrix, it provides hiding places. And hiding places in nature mean opportunity. Opportunity to hide, whether you're predator or prey. But ultimately, it's that that then can enable so many species to find a way to survive there. Well, this three-dimensional structure, this is a big part of the challenge if you're a big predator. And particularly if you're a big predator that wants to try and catch the little fish that live in the reef. And two of the major predators on a reef are groupers, you know, big mouth, big toothed fish, and octopus, completely different, a cephalopod, a mollusk, soft bodied, and they have very different strategies of working the same area of reef. The grouper is too big to get into the cracks, but he's very good and very fast for catching the fish outside. But what we see is often when there's a little fish moving out and the grouper comes in, well, the little fish can just go and hide back into that three-dimensional structure. Well, for the octopus, it's converse. So for the octopus, and he's got this body that can get through the tiniest gaps with eight maneuverable arms, and he can weave his way through inside the reef, but he tries to get that little fish, and it pops out the reef, right, and it can hide outside, yeah, and it's gone. So what we witnessed and filmed, and this was, it was broken down by this amazing scientist who actually is a cameraman who has grown up on the Great Barrier Reef called Alex Vail. And he, through weeks and months and years on these reefs, started to observe this and actually worked out this one particular pair who have teamed up. So rather than being competitors, they've realized...
The octopus and the grouper.
The octopus and the grouper have realized that rather than being competitors, they're better to team up. Because if they're hunting together, then if the octopus scare the fish in, the octopus can get it. If the octopus scare the fish out, then the grouper can get it. And these are two... So Alex, the scientist, now speculates that this, you know, potentially puts a grouper's cognition. So, because it's not just that they team up, it's that, let's say, the grouper sees a fish and he's trying to get to it, but he can't. He will swim over to find the octopus. He will do a display for the octopus, and the octopus... Okay, I know what you want.
We've got to work this one together.
Yeah, then the two of them will swim over. But of course, the grouper's still got to show the octopus where this fish is. So the grouper does a headstand, points directly at the fish, even changes colour to let the octopus know. Then the octopus can go in the reef, and it's 50-50 who gets it. But if you think about that degree of forward planning, of the grouper.
Communication.
And to think.
Interspecies communication.
Yes.
Cephalopod and a fish don't speak the same language.
Absolutely.
I've heard, and perhaps you, in your observation over the few years that you've been filming this, I've heard that an octopus is a tremendously intelligent thing. And I've heard things said about the octopus that boggle the mind and make me not ever want to eat calamari because I feel that I'm almost eating something that could be as smart as I am.
That's the problem. Actually, that's a bit of a problem with Blue Planet too, is because you're going to realize that all these animals, and actually animals that we might think are familiar, whether it's a squid, an octopus, a fish, actually do so much more than you'd ever imagined.
Well, let's just go back to this bleaching the reef, because this, I think, is an interesting point of departure for a lot of people in terms of what Blue Planet 2 is really about. It's this investigation of the most undiscovered part of our planet. 70% of the surface is covered in water. We know very little about what happens in the depths, and even some of the stuff on the surface, because we've only really been exploring it properly in anything but a surface way for the last maybe 40, 50 years. When you watch the reef bleach, when you see this whole-scale destruction of what is this enormous living organism, what is this habitat for so many other little organisms that live in it, does it fill you with dread? Are you concerned and nervous about the future of the planet, or are you filled with hope that we will find a way to stop being destructive just in time?
It's tricky because I'm an optimist, and in a way, I mean, to try and sit in the field for weeks and weeks and months believing that a behavior is going to happen, you've got to be an optimist. Otherwise you'd go crazy. But equally, I'm a realist, and the realism comes from what you see. And the future of the barrier reef and really corals around the world is a matter of very strong debate right now, whether there is hope or not. Some scientists will tell you that actually, because of all the other factors, global warming, acidification, pollution, as well as, you know, the ultimate effects of bleaching, that all coral reefs will be gone by the end of this century. Whereas others are more hopeful. And I do believe that nature has an extraordinary ability to find a way. And actually, if you look back to the last ice age, the Red Sea, all life in the Red Sea was wiped out. But in the 10,000 years since, corals have got back in and recolonized. And I think that shows us that coral can find a way, but it takes time. And I think that is the major thing, is time, and it's the rate of changes that we potentially are seeing now, but that we can still curb. And I think that's wherein lies the hope. And I think that the most important thing is for us to realize now that these changes are happening.
Now, there's a lot of talk about this island in the middle of the Pacific that's made of plastic. And plastic is a major problem in the oceans, not just for turtles. We know about how much trouble they have with it, but for all marine life. Did you, in your encounters with plastic in the sea, have any thoughts on this? Did you make any discoveries? How large is the scale of the problem?
Plastic is everywhere. And, you know, wherever you are, I don't think I've been anywhere in the entirety of the world's oceans, and that's every continent, and not seen plastic.
Even in Antarctica?
Even in Antarctica, even in the Arctic, and on the beaches and around, you see it. You know, the oceans are connected. There aren't five oceans, there aren't seven seas. Actually, if you look at a globe and you look at it from the South Pole, you see that every single ocean is connected. And that is part of actually what keeps life going on Earth. The fact that super dense water sinks in the poles, it comes up at the equator, and it keeps this eternal movement of the oceans, which then creates our weather, creates our oxygen. You know, they're the reason that there's any life. But it also means that this connectivity, this one ocean, means that plastic can drift anywhere and get anywhere. You know, it's unlimited where it can end up. We're finding plastic at the very bottom of the ocean. Microplastics at the very, very bottom, thousands of meters deep. And so, without doubt, plastic is a major issue. And actually, in our fourth program, the Open Ocean program, you really see it firsthand and the effect that it can have on cetaceans in particular. But because of this, and actually because of the kind of viewing figures that we're talking about, and the amount of excitement over Blue Planet 2 and the emotional investment that people are having with our stories, with our new discoveries, with the journeys that you go on, we're seeing it actually affect a change. And plastics now in the UK, after Blue Planet 2, are a massive point of discussion, to the point that our Prime Minister has been talking about it with regard to Blue Planet 2, that in the budget, Blue Planet 2 was mentioned with regard to bringing a tax in on plastics. You know, we are seeing this sea change in people's approach to plastics. And it's baby steps, you know. We've lived with plastic for so long that we're never going to change it overnight. But it's the little things we can do. Do we need to use a plastic straw? Can we use a paper straw instead, for instance?
And can we recycle what we already have?
Yes. You know,
isn't it cheaper to do that than to make new stuff every time?
I would say absolutely. And again, it's these, you know, and of course, conservation agencies have been talking about plastic for a really long time, and it's not down to Blue Planet 2. But I think what we're doing is having that conversation.
Is there an actual island of plastic?
I haven't seen it, but I've certainly heard about it. Mm. And, you know, you see images of it. And the way ocean currents work, and with gyres and so on, it makes absolute sense that a lot of plastic would pool in one place.
Absolutely terrifying. All right, so let's just talk about the variety of oceanic environments that you were exposed to. In particular, I would imagine that because there are a few producers and you all deal with different parts of what you want to create in a narrative, you'll all be parceled off into different parts of the world, and there you'll spend some time trying to gather as much really great footage as you can. First of all, how much time do you have? Second of all, how many people do you have to work the cameras, fly the drones, do all the things that you can do now with technology? And do you have enough money to do it?
Sure. So, working backwards, potentially, we have to have enough money because we've got the amount of money that we're given and we have to try and film it for
it. But the BBC deserve a massive thanks for this, because as a state broadcaster of a kind and as a public service, the BBC has decided to put its money where its mouth is in respect of shows like Blue Planet. They know they're tremendously successful, so it has a commercial value to them as well. But the fact that they did this before it was commercially something anyone had explored as, you know, something that they could bring in sponsors and advertisers and all kinds of other things to, they did it because it was the right thing to do.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think that as well we're incredibly lucky to have the backing of the BBC, because I can't imagine us pulling off a series like this without that.
No. So the money, you get a certain budget.
And we make it work for that. But So we, just as you say, we've filmed in every part of the ocean, and it's very much that we are, as again, as you say, you're split into different teams for the different programs.
Now, did you have a preference before you went into this, or was it a lucky draw where you, oh shit, I got the Antarctic?
No, it tends to come. Do you know what? Antarctica is the most beautiful place on the planet. It really is.
But it is hostile.
It is hostile, but do you know what? With hostility comes challenge, and with that can often come wonder. It comes down to your areas of expertise generally. I've spent a lot of time on coral reefs around the world, and in my previous life in marine science as well. And so for me, the coral reef was very much a film that I wanted to make, and that was a natural one for me. And then the other film that I really wanted to make was the opening film, to try and give a bigger picture of the oceans, and not just with new discoveries, new species, new worlds, but also a new understanding, and a new understanding of what life can do, but also of what the oceans mean to us and their importance to our planet. So for me, they were two very natural films. And the other producers, again, because of their own passions, their own experience, were really well suited for their programs. And we've got a program on the deep sea, coral reefs that I've mentioned, one on the open ocean, one on the green seas of the planet, where we have the most amazing sequence shot in Cape Town. I have to tell you about that in a minute. It's gobsmacking. It's just extraordinary. And then we've got a film on the world's coastlines, and then our final film, which is it steers away slightly from pure natural history and ties in the stories that you've seen through the series and brings in the scientists, the explorers that are out there working these things out. So, you know, that's how you kind of split up. And so, for instance, then the time you spend there and the teams you have. Orla Doherty, our producer of the Deep program, spent 1,000 hours in submarines down in the deep sea in order to, you know, get this footage. And it's really interesting you ask how big your team is, because that's really where we get really lucky. And it's another point where you feel incredibly privileged, in that I've got my core production team, so my film in Bristol in England at the Natural History Unit. But that's where we start. And, you know, we'll spend a year researching with amazing researchers there, looking out and talking to, just getting the word around the world that we want to try and make this series, and that it's, you know, with a genuine goal of discovering new behavior, of filming first, but also of showing the world what the oceans really are. And that's where our team becomes so much bigger, when scientists around the world, when divers, boat captains, people that spend all their time in the ocean, you know, some people that might have spent their entire career looking at one animal, and when they see what we're doing, and they believe that the BBC will do it right, they start sharing these stories with us. And again, that's when you suddenly have a whole world feeding back to you. And that's really how we end up finding, you know, these extraordinary stories that we do.
Something I need to know about that opening sequence, and I don't know how much of it is yours necessarily, or I don't think it matters to you, because I think you're all very proud of the end product. But there is such beautiful moving picture of waves crashing, and of what it looks like from underneath, and what it looks like from above, and dolphins jumping through the waves, and whales sleeping vertically in the water. But four or five of these enormous, enormous animals sleeping and hanging in the ocean. When you see that, do you know it's magic immediately?
It's some things that we want to target, actually. So, and that one with sleeping whales was one of those. Then comes the challenge of actually trying to film it. Same with the surfing dolphins as well. What I really wanted to do with that is I wanted to start off the series with something really magical and fun. But also take an animal that you probably think you know, a bottlenose dolphin, and then show you what it does so much more. You know, that's something we try and do a lot with this series. Yes, you'll see the complete alien. You'll see animals that you had no idea that existed. But we'll also take animals that you think you do know, the bottlenose dolphin, Nemo, the clownfish, and show you actually, and by taking you on a journey with it through its world, you'll make these new discoveries.
And there's a scene where these two dolphins, I think it's a mother and baby, they swim out for what looks like 100, 200 meters of distance, and they come back right over the cameras, almost as if you trained them to do it, like a great dance sequence where they come right in front of the audience and then disappear into the distance again. It's magnificent.
Well, thank you.
How many things have to hit the cutting room floor before you get that?
Do you know, an awful lot. And we come back with hours and hours of footage, you know, hundreds of hours potentially. But so much of what we do, it's about that one moment. And it's capturing that moment and then building the story around it. And with that one, with the dolphins, that was in the Red Sea. I was working with a South African cameraman called Roger Horrocks, amazing cameraman based down in Cape Town. And it was actually, it's funny you say that about those dolphins being far away and coming in, because we found a really interesting challenge with that particular sequence. And that is that our general mantra when we're filming is to not be seen. And because if an animal knows you're there, it will, not always, but most often, start doing something slightly different.
Well, it's the theory of relativity, you know, that the observed then knows it's observed and changes its behavior accordingly. These dolphins knew you were there. They were looking right at the camera.
They were, but what we did, first of all, was to try and not be seen. And so, you know, we wear camouflage wetsuits. We'll build underwater hides. We wear rebreathers so we're not blowing any bubbles. We're not making any noise. And that was the approach that we tried with these dolphins to start with. So we're there, hidden in the reef, and not being seen. And the dolphins would swim on by, because we knew that they potentially were going to do this behavior, and we'd heard about it, but, you know, how to film and how to get in with them. And so we're hidden away, and they would come by, and then they would carry on going, and with no interest in us. A dolphin, as slow as it's swimming, is a lot faster than us. And luckily, we're working with this great researcher who had spent years and years with the dolphins. And she knew that there were certain times where actually they were looking to have some fun on the reef, and they would play games on. And she said, what we have to do is, when they come in and when they're in the right mood, do the opposite. Don't try and stay hidden.
Show them you're there.
Show them you're there. Get excited. Move around a bit. Say, hey, good morning. And then, hey, good morning. And then, instead of swimming by, they would stop and they would come over, just like you saw. And they would even go and get the rest of the pod. Say, hey, guys, come and check these guys out over here.
God, isn't it fantastic to know that there's this, and we come back to this intelligence idea, because humans have this massive superiority complex. We think that we're the pinnacle of all evolved life, and that all evolved life should want to end up where we are. And we forget that dolphins are the most perfect end of that branch of evolution, and that an octopus or a kind of living coral is another piece of that evolutionary tree. And that all of these endings are the most perfect current state of development for that organism. And you see a dolphin and you think, well, these things are actually living pretty interesting, carefree, pleasant, exciting lives. And they do things like surf, which we would do in our spare time if we didn't have to work and all of this stuff. And they do it probably more of the time than we do.
Do you know, you're absolutely right that it's a real sign that of success, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you see that with that surf and dolphin sequence that we shot off the Transkei. And it's very much, dolphins are one of the few animals that we know of that potentially do play. And there's also potentially other reasons for it that we're working out. For instance, you know,
social reasons.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And, you know, it can be a bit like if you're out surfing with your friends. Yeah. And, you know, and
socially
it's just,
cohesive.
Yeah,
and, yeah.
You're absolutely right. But it's without doubt, as you say, a sign of success of an animal when it potentially is just taking that time out to play.
It's living. It's enjoying being alive. You said you filmed something off of Cape Town that was particularly interesting.
It's such a cool story.
What happened?
Okay, so, again, it's another a case of, you know, our team becoming so much bigger and these amazing people feeding backstories. Yeah. And there's a cameraman down in Cape Town called Craig Foster who has spent 6 years pretty much every morning snorkeling the kelp forests and starting to observe the animals, and much like he would if he was in the bush tracking animals, starting to observe and work things out. And one thing in particular, it's an octopus again. And this rather diminutive octopus who lives in the very competitive world of the kelp forest.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as we all know, Cape Town's fairly renowned for its sharks and its big sharks, but also its smaller sharks. And the kelp forest is actually an area rife with predators and things like cat sharks, pajama sharks, these smaller sharks mm-hmm. as well, that work their way through, and tenacious predators. Well, if you're an octopus, a nice, soft-bodied, very tasty morsel, you can imagine that you live a life where you've got to be on your guard, let's say. Well, Craig worked out, and then working alongside Roger Horrocks again, a cameraman from Cape Town, they managed to film a behavior where a shark was hunting the octopus. And the octopus's defense in something that had never, ever been documented before takes over 80 pieces of shell of stone, and with its tentacles completely covers its body and essentially armor plates itself. And at the same time as armor plating itself, its scent is being kept in. And so the shark swims on by. And, you know, that's this amazing solution to staying alive with this octopus.
So clever.
So clever.
And this has never been filmed before.
Never.
What other things did you find that had never been filmed before? Because when you're dealing with the ocean, there must be still many things that haven't been filmed.
There are, and we're very lucky, actually. And through, you know, it's unprecedented, but through this series, we've now got over 10 scientific papers being written on what we discovered from our filming. And, you know, we spent over 6,000 hours underwater for this series. And when you spend that much time, you start to observe and you work things out. And actually, it's amazing how closely science and new discoveries and our filmmaking come. And actually, a lot of times, it's really amalgamated. And for instance, we're up in Norway, and we're working with scientists there to put a camera on the back of a killer whale. But it's a very small camera, but it's also built into it are 12 scientific sensors. And by then, with the footage that we eventually got after 2.5 years, that's another long story, sure, of trying to get the camera on the back of a whale, we succeeded. And the whale then did the filming for us as it's right in the middle of this massive bait ball with a load of other orca and with humpback whales even coming in. And it gave us an incredibly privileged view. But the science that has also come out of that is now, so even things like the hydrophone on it, and you can see one orca come in and do a big tail slap in front of the camera, and the tail slap is to knock out a load of fish. Before, we'd always assume that it's a pressure wave that does it, but what you hear is it's like flicking a deck of cards, and you can hear and count visually as well as hearing how many fish it's just hit as it's knocked out. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and then it comes back round and slurps them up one by one. And it's this really unique view that we're able to get.
Incredible.
Another one of the, you know, one of the actually many scientific discoveries, but is, and papers are writing now, is again, if I take the humble clownfish, and something that, you know, we think we know and we've seen in Nemo and so on. Well, there's a clownfish off Borneo that lives in an anemone that burrows in the sand just off the reef. And what this means is the clownfish has managed to sort of get away from the competition of reef life by finding this perfect little niche in this burrowing anemone. But with that comes challenge. And the challenge is that a clownfish needs something hard to lay its eggs on. And for a clownfish living on a burrowing anemone away from the reef, it's just soft sediment around it. So it may have the protection of the anemone, but it's got nowhere to lay its eggs. And what we discovered through various different means, it originally came to me from a cameraman who had heard about it 10 years ago. And we thought,
sort of like a rumor.
Just like a rumor, exactly. Couldn't find any pictures of it, couldn't find any film of it, but thought, you know, this is interesting. We started digging. And then I was talking to a scientist in Papua New Guinea, and he had been studying these clownfish and studying them for how many eggs they laid. And he had taken down sort of like a kitchen tile to put under the anemone, a perfect little hard thing for them to lay their eggs on. And he was saying to us, do you know though, when I'd go down, I'd find these random bits of flotsam and jetsam stuck in the anemone. And he sent me a picture of one with a baby doll's arm, like a plastic arm, so strange, tucked under the anemone. But he said, you know, I would go down and find this bit. So I threw this little random baby doll's arm away and slotted the perfect, lovely tile to lay the eggs on under the anemone. I came back a week or so later, and the tile was a few metres away from the anemone, and the baby doll's arm was perfectly tucked underneath it, covered in eggs. So this made us think, okay, that something's happening here, and they're obviously pushing things away and selecting certain objects that they like. So we then went to Borneo, and we spent, myself and the cameraman Roger Munns, spent over 100 hours with this one family on our rebreathers, sitting there watching. And in the end, actually, we saw them try a few different things. We saw them try a plastic bottle, but it was too light and just drifted away. We even saw them try a hermit crab, but you can imagine that the crab...
Well, hermit crab didn't like this.
He
yeah.
wasn't too impressed, no. And then eventually, because it's in tidal currents there, and half a coconut shell came drifting through. And that appeared to be just the right thing for them. And they swam over to it by the male, first of all, because he's got to try and impress the female. And then he started nudging it and pushing it, and it was obviously just the right size. And then between the two of them, they managed to lift it, carry it, push it, roll it over to their anemone, and then tuck it in under the protective folds and lay their eggs on it.
Building a house.
Essentially building a house, yeah.
I mean, this is how birds make a nest, for example. It's incredible. And this has never been really captured in that sense on film.
No, not even slightly. All I could find is one reference from a paper in the late 1970s. And since then, no mention of it anywhere.
Now, you've dedicated your life to filming and specializing in filming in underwater sort of wildlife films. And you've done a number of projects for the BBC. You've done a bear's one for Disney Nature too. I imagine that for you, it must be a sort of lonely experience a lot of the time. You're not often at home when you're doing these projects. You're far away, and you're away for a long period of time. And then you're sitting in an edit suite, probably on your own or at least with one or two other people, but it's work. Is it lonely? Is it something very gratifying? I mean, what's the take home for you?
A take home is actually, yes, it can be. It can be very hard, and that I mean, I don't want to sound ungrateful. You know, I get to have some of the most amazing adventures and see the most amazing things. But actually, one of the biggest challenges for me nowadays is being away from my family. And even as you very astutely say, even when you're in the edit, it's actually a lot of intense time locked away. But particularly when you're in the field.
And, you know, I mean, would your daughters recognize you in a lineup?
I hope so, just about. But, you know, they're 4 and 6, and they're an absolute ball, and they're so much fun. But I think I found that actually slightly affecting how I look at wildlife stories sometimes. And in the opening episode, we have a sequence with a mother walrus and her pup. And I was up in the Arctic with my team and working particularly closely with the cameraman Ted Giffords, working the topside. And we would be sitting on the boat for, you know, hours and hours. And up there in the summer, you've got 24-hour sunshine. So you get a lot of opportunity when the conditions are right to film. And we went up there thinking that we were going to film, or with the plan of filming what we expected walrus to be, you know, what you typically hear of them being, quite thuggish, brutish animals, a little bit funny. And actually, I thought it was going to be quite a funny sequence of these thuggish animals fighting, squabbling to get onto ice. Then when we were there, both Ted and I went on quite a considerable emotional journey with them. And I do wonder if the fact that we both had small children left at home was part of it. But what we saw was a very, very different sequence. For a start, there was less ice that year than potentially on record. The people I was working with, the Norwegians who had generations of experience there, you know, their parents and so on, had worked the ice, and they were all saying there was less ice this year than ever before. And it meant that we could take our boat further into the Arctic than any film, natural history film crew had. But it also meant that we saw this challenge facing these walrus, and this challenge actually being to try and find ice, to try and find a safe haul out for their pups. And the walrus mothers, rather than being these brutish, funny animals, we actually saw the most caring and attentive mother that I've ever seen in nature. And if you can imagine, a walrus is really cold up there, and a walrus is covered in blubber, and it actually can't feel through its skin. But what they have is these very, very sensitive whiskers. And these whiskers, they use them for feeling around on the seabed and detecting prey. But they also use them for communicating with each other. And you would see these mother walrus, when they finally, after really quite an epic struggle, manage to get their babies, these tiny little babies, to safety, then you would see them kissing, or at least that has what looked like kissing, as the mum was imprinting herself on her. Really, you know, that's the time where this walrus mum is teaching a baby everything it needs to know in this changing Arctic world.
That's incredible. I didn't think that a walrus would make that sort of connection. Just shows you how little we know.
Doesn't it?
Tell me, when you're out there doing all of this, and you're obviously getting wet, you're in wetsuits and you're in and out of boats, and I mean, do you love the sea, or are you sort of sick of that, that motion, that perpetual back and forth, that rocking, pitching and rolling, and what's the scariest thing about the sea for you now? You must have developed a huge sense of respect for the ocean.
I think anybody that spends a lot of time at sea has a massive respect for it, and I don't think I could ever get tired of the ocean, the magic, the wonder, the awe, and the, you know, the scale, and also the sheer feeling that we know so little about it. I grew up on a beach down in Cornwall in England, and I've always been very much a water baby. And so really, when this series came along, it was my dream project, like truly. And so now I could, do you know what? I could readily do another five of these.
Wow. What sea creatures still frighten you? Are there any that frighten you? Which ones are most wonderful to you?
Okay, I don't think any animal really frightens me. I think they're all wonderful in their own ways.
But because a lot of people are frightened by some of these sea creatures.
A lot of people aren't. I think it's a really intriguing thing about the ocean, and actually the inherent fear that a lot of people have for it. And I wonder, I mean, I'd love to know what you think and why that is, but I wonder if a part of it is just, it's slightly being out of our element, and also the amount of unknown. I don't know how much the likes of Jaws and so on did for that.
I think it might have to do just with the fact that we are not able to master that domain like we can land. And it's ironic that we must have evolved out of water originally. But we've now got this fear. It's sort of primordial, and it maybe kicks in an instinct that when we were just some semi-amphibious thing that had no control over its destiny, that maybe we feel like we're going backwards, and when we're in the water, we're suddenly more vulnerable than ever before. And also, there are creatures that sting us and bite us and want to eat us and don't particularly like us coming into their homes.
No, I think that's a very fair point. I wonder, though, if there's also an element that swings the other way, and that's actually a potential dependence that we've always had. You know, you look how much of it is made up of water. Mm. And I do wonder if there's not also a natural, you know, I don't think it's just sheer discovery, but I wonder if, as you're saying, something primordial, where actually it was actually the coastlines that could offer us so much food and so much opportunity, however many hundreds of thousands of years ago. And I wonder if actually, because I certainly personally, I feel this great affinity with the oceans, really, something about sitting on a cliff and just looking out to sea that I could do for hours and hours on end. And I've never quite put my finger on why that is.
It's very therapeutic. It's why people go to the beach. They sometimes don't get into the water. Sometimes there isn't even sun. And they'll sit there and watch the waves crashing over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And it just gets you thinking. Mm-hmm. But I am curious because there are some, I mean, when you deal with sharks and you know, I have no hatred for sharks. I know lots of people are terrified by them. But what you have to be careful around some of these animals.
You have to be incredibly careful.
Whales are enormous. Without even meaning to, they can kill you.
It's really interesting you say that, because actually all the cameramen that I know have spent a lot of time in the water, and really all the people have spent a lot of time with wildlife. It's big whales that have given them the biggest scares. Because, as you say, they're so big.
They don't know what they're doing. You're a fly. You're a gnat.
That's exactly right. And, you know, they come and get inquisitive and give you a little knock. Well, we're not really designed to receive those knocks. But it all comes down, you know, with our job, it all comes down to approaching things in the right way and taking baby steps. You know, we're not jumping in and trying to film a sequence in 5 days and trying to get it all covered and try and force an issue. It's all about slowly, slowly trying and taking as small as teams as we can into the field, really then for a couple of reasons. One, to impact as less possible. Also, to make the budget stretch further and to give us as long as we can there.
To get the magic.
Because it's all about that time underwater. And if we start taking risks, well, not only do you risk a harm to the people in the water, a harm to the equipment, well, actually, if anything goes wrong there, that's your shoot over. And then, you know, you've got to look at it that chances are we're not going to get this behavior for another 2 weeks. And quite honestly, the thing that I worry about most with sending teams around the world is the travel, and particularly them being in cars in remote places. I think that's more dangerous than sharks.
Yeah, you're probably right. David Attenborough he's the face and the voice of the environment. To so many people, he's the guy who introduced them to a monkey or a squirrel or a mollusk or a fish for the first time. And perhaps for many of us, he's the man who got us interested in the wonders of the natural world for the first time. Is it almost too much to be around someone who has such a gravity of personal charm and effect that it sucks you in and you can't treat him as the subject of a sequence? Or is it something that you've now become quite used to and you're almost a bit blasé about being around Sir David Attenborough because you've probably spent a lot of time around him?
I've been lucky enough to spend some time around him for this series, but I certainly could never get blasé about such a great man. You know how sometimes in life you stand next to somebody and you know you're truly standing next to greatness. And that very much is Sir David. I mean, he's 91, and he is so sharp. And he puts, you know, the likes of young pretenders like me really in our place. Just because it just makes you realize how little you really know. You know, he's spent however many decades, really pioneering the trade that we're here talking about now. And, you know, it's really built up natural history and natural history documentaries, and particularly what the BBC stands for it. And what, you know, with being privileged enough to have worked with him on this series, what one of the many things actually about him that's really blown me away, but is his incredible affinity and ability to tell stories and to tell it in a way that makes sense to everybody. And we might, these stories that you and I have been talking about, that, you know, we will have gone and spent months and months, a couple of years filming, then we'll put it together in the edit, and this one amazing moment that we've managed to film and, you know, we've crafted together to show you, and then we'll take it to him, because Attenborough does all the words for this series, and we'll say, look, here's this, and, you know, great behaviour, and we've done this, and he'll look at it, and quite quickly he can say, well, it's brilliant, but what about if we just say this instead of that? And he'll look at it and think, well, of course. Why didn't I think of that? It makes so much sense. And he's, yeah, I don't know what else to say apart from brilliant.
So he can connect what the scientists see to what ordinary people want to feel.
Absolutely. And I think if you look at his career, I think that's what one of the things that really epitomizes his success. And I would say why what has drawn a lot of people to work in the natural world.
That's an unbelievable privilege. Look, it's a great privilege to meet you. And as I said to you before, as an artist, to have been a part of something this magnificent will be sort of an eternal shining light in your CV, I'm sure. And this isn't by no means the end for you of this kind of filming. There's no end in sight, actually, because the oceans are so deep and there is so much to still learn, and there are so many of these creatures that we can still get to know. And I'm just delighted that I could meet someone who's helping us to get closer to them. Thank you so much for all your hard work.
You're incredibly kind. Thank you so much for having me here. It's been a real pleasure.
Make sure you watch Blue Planet 2. It premieres in South Africa this coming weekend, and there will be a DVD.
Absolutely.
One of those things that you want to put on the shelf and that you want to show the kids and the grandkids and the great-grandkids, and one day you want to look back on. And hopefully we'll see a world that we haven't ruined even more, but one that we've managed to save in the nick of time. Thank you very much. CliffCentral.com.